Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how successful is the United Nations in achieving its sustainable development goals for poverty reduction, economic development, environmental protection, and political empowerment? And first, on Christmas Day, the great author and journalist William Grider passed away. He was the author of 7 books, including Secrets of the Temple, about the Federal Reserve Bank, and Who Will Tell the People, about the savings and loan crisis. To remember Bill Grider, we are re-airing our interview with him about his book, Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. Our next guest says that America is at a crossroads, culturally, economically, and politically, and its advancement or decline depends on which way it goes. William Grider is author of Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. Welcome back, Bill Grider.
Thank you, Maria.
I want to start with, I think it's your second sentence in this book, and you said, beyond recession and financial crisis, we are in much deeper trouble than many people suppose or the authorities want to acknowledge. How deep is the trouble?
I think we are at an historic turning point in our country's history. I mean, and it will be profoundly changing in the way Americans live and how we think about ourselves. We are going to learn humility, which is not one of our strongest traits. We are going to face facts that do not yield to our bravado or can-do spirit. And it's going to be hard. It's going to be a hard passage for Americans, both in economic terms, but also it's going to force us to give up on some comforting illusions about ourselves and the world. You know, this long-running notion that because we're so good and great and powerful and good-hearted, we get to run the world, and the other countries will fall in line because we are so good. And, you know, that's sustained a lot of good stuff, I think, but also it has powered the fact that we're such a overbearing an awesomely armed country that does, in fact, use its power to bend people to our will. And that's over. I mean, if not instantly, of course. But I think the idea of America's number one is over, and people should get used to that.
Now, you said that there are 5 elements that are driving a deterioration. Let's go through them quickly, and then we'll detail them. Globalization.
Globalization, the way the United States has approached it, has gravely weakened American economic strength. That's expressed most clearly in the giant trade deficits. But people, I think, everywhere also glimpse it when they see long-established manufacturing sectors steadily undermined, either by moving production elsewhere or simply unable to compete with low-wage workers on the other end of the system. A second, maybe a little harder for people to see, is the mass consumption society, which we have all enjoyed one way or another for really the last 50 or 60 years, is now, I think, doomed in the sense that it has to change and will be changed by events. And that's a combination of the ecological crisis, global warming and other dimensions, but also the scarcity of oil. And this is now in discussion, at least in popular politics, for the first time seriously in many decades, which is good. But I don't think people have yet grasped what the depth of the transformation that this is going to produce. Another dimension would be militarism. And I use that word with hesitation, but it really is about relying on our military power to shape our foreign policy. And that has created these vast deployments all over the world, some of them well-known and visible, but a lot of them actually clandestine in the form of special forces, Green Berets, and so forth. And I argue, again with some hesitation, but I conclude that the military institution in the United States is now probably the gravest threat to our peace and security because it's created those tripwires, because it's literally circling the globe looking for somebody to punch it in the chin. And guess what? That happens, doesn't it? I'm really nervous on that level, and I'm trying to make it clear I'm not indicting even admirals and generals or the military institution per se, because it's filling a vacuum which was allowed and encouraged for many years during the Cold War. And instead of backing off and saying, wait a minute, this is out of balance, this is way too much and dangerous, we keep stumbling forward. There are a couple of more, but the one that is fundamental to everything else is the dysfunctional democracy. And again, people at large know this, and they've known it for years, that we have our representative democracy is not functioning. It's wildly out of balance. Powerful interests of various kinds dominate and in some ways hold a veto power over the elected government, and the elected Congress, for instance, more or less goes along with that, unable or afraid to resist. And the party that's left out are the people, and I mean that broadly, and I'm not making distinctions between liberals and conservatives or young or old or rich or poor. It's a general condition. The two parties are both failing in those terms, and again, it's a bipartisan indictment. Finally, Maria, not to monopolize, but the hard part of what I'm trying to explain, and the most important part, is that we won't get out of this whole and equitably and create a better country on the other side if the people do not step up and assert themselves as citizens. I know that sounds plausible to a lot of cynical people, but that's the way American history has always worked.
I want to get back to that, but I wanted to go through some of these a little bit more in detail. So if we were, for example, going to start with the globalization issue and the economic issue, you also talked about in your book about the free market ideology,
yeah,
and how that's affecting everything from culture to the economic system. And if we tie it into what's going on today, so you've said, look, this economic crisis was not a perfect storm, as Wall Street would like everybody to believe. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this.
Yes. Well, you could make a case that our financial crisis, which was really inflated valuations and sometimes often fraudulent valuations, building up debt in the society at a level that was crazy, really, when you look back on it. And part of the reason that the financial system could do that is because the country was sinking into debt through the trading system. And it's not just enough to say that some steel workers and some auto workers or others were hurt by jobs moving offshore. It was the economy overall that has been gravely weakened. And so that produces those sort of weird imbalance where the financial sector gets larger and larger, even as the productive sector is not. Now that's, you know, anybody who understands the relationships in capitalism knows that's out of whack. What happened, I believe, and I assert in the book, is that because of our distinctive position, we won World War II, we helped reorganize the peace, and we relaunched global trade, all, you know, created the UN, all virtuous things. But that led eventually to a kind of self-glorifying arrogance, to put it bluntly. And we then engaged global trade in a way that was different from every other advanced industrial economy. All of those countries, whether you're talking about Japan or Germany or France or many others, insisted that their multinationals keep a set of obligations to the home country. And that was about keeping the good jobs there. It was about keeping a balance with the rest of the world. And they all struggled with the same pressures. The United States was distinctive because our government and our private sector promoted and advanced the notion that our national interest would be served if our U.S. multinationals did well in the world, and everybody else would somehow benefit from that. Well, that has been demonstrably not true for many years, and yet it's still pretty much the core belief of the governing elites in charge. And I'm including Democrats as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I can recall, you know, finding Democrats carrying bills to subsidize advertising overseas for fast food chains.
Right. And the, you know, the tax issues, which Obama raised, have been around for 30 plus years. So what's rare is that a Democratic president has the courage to stand up and raise it again.
And one of the other issues that you have brought up in this book, and you've written an entire tome on it, is the Federal Reserve. And you say this is one of the biggest culprits.
Yeah.
There's so much conspiracy theory out there around the Federal Reserve and its mystique. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of this institution and what its role is in all this?
Well, I did write this rather long book, as you're familiar with.
Secrets of the Temple, right in front of me.
20 years ago. The Fed is deliberately cloaked in obfuscation and mystique, and it's cloistered from political accountability. And, of course, that feeds conspiratorial theories about who really runs things and so forth and so on. I try to get past those because, having spent a lot of time running through them, there's some factual truth in some of what the critics say. The problem is when you've cleared away all of the complications, the Federal Reserve is part of the federal government. It's different from the rest of the federal government, mainly because it is protected from political accountability, and that was quite deliberate. When they created the Fed in 1913, that was the banking system saying, we need a central bank to keep us from crashing every couple of years. And so the central bank was positioned between capital and labor, basically, and it was supposed to balance between those two pressures. It was shielded from public accountability because the fear of the financiers was that, well, if you let the unruly public have something to say about this, they will immediately push for easy credit and too much money, and we'll wind up with inflation. And, of course, what the Fed did in the last generation, and did it was all in broad daylight, they pushed the opposite way. They shifted the balance. Instead of being moderating force, they shifted the balance hard in front of capital and financial wealth and against labor. They suppressed wages by keeping money tight and literally keeping the economy from growing as fast as it was ready to grow. And on the other side, they stripped away the regulations and the prudential rules that control the financial system and the banking system from going crazy. And they said, hey, there's no tomorrow. Let's go for it. You guys are the titans of finance, and you know what you're doing, and we will step back and not really interfere with your own plans to, quote, modernize the system. Well, I've been writing this in various forms ever since I wrote that book in 1987 when I described the triumph of money, as I put it in the last chapter. And candidly, it didn't get much response from anybody in official positions, to put it mildly, because everybody was riding the same train saying, this is wonderful. Look at the Dow Jones. Look at the expanding financial wealth. And I was one of those bag ladies on the street corner saying, it's all an illusion, and it's going to come down with great wreckage and pain.
You have, at the end, written 6 imperatives to guide transformation and restore well-being.
Oh, gosh, do I remember?
Well, I'll start you.
Start me. First thing.
Number one, you say, is we've got to restore a moral principle and a public obligation to corporations. Now, you and I actually met at a quasi think tank group that dealt with this very issue. So how might we approach this restoring moral principle and public obligation to corporations?
Well, the good news is that a lot of people inside corporations know this failing, and they are advocates themselves, at least in their quiet way, for profoundly reforming the corporate institution. And that has to be done by rule of law, but it also has to be done by individuals, not just the managements or even the shareholders, although they can be part of this, but the employees who work there at every level, by suppliers, by customers. The phrase I use in the book is we have to thicken democracy. And by that I mean building the kind of structure of rules and obligations that allow most every sector and stakeholder to participate, not just listen to speeches, but to actually be at the table participating in the decision-making. And, this is crucial, informing the people at the top of the ladder, the managers, the CEO, of realities that they do not see. There's nothing fancy about this idea. It's actually a picture of a healthy democracy. But it does not exist, for the most part, in our workplaces, in a lot of our largest and most powerful institutions. Here's the thing, that people want to get into fights between liberals and conservatives. I know, because I've traveled around the country, you will get people, I don't care what their party label or the ideological perspective is, you will get people to agree with that, to just say, yeah, of course, this society is organized top-down. not in every respect, but in most respects. And that's not what this country was founded for. We've been here at it for a couple hundred years, and we'll be at it many more, pursuing that goal. But that's the American ideal that we ought to revive now and make active.
The basis of what you're saying here is that for so long we've been trading off this kind of living about things that are meaningful, trading it off for maximizing profit and wealth and getting ahead and this kind of mass consumerism, making more than the next guy or whatever that happens to be.
And one of the things that I think is, and people know this, but one of the things that's askew in our country is that process actually, at least for the last generation, has produced deepening insecurity.
Yeah, no doubt.
And even fear. Not the pleasurable life that it supposedly promises. But nevertheless, one way or another, most all of us are trapped in that, because how do you step back from it? It's not easy, right? And I think people make that choice, but it's very hard. And I am not one of those people who recommends a simple life. You know, we go back to nuts and berries and living without cars or whatever. But we do need to talk about how we can turn the pressure down and give people more space in their lives. And I use the phrase, trying to answer that question you read of what do you tell people when the good times ain't coming back? What can you offer them? And my answer is larger lives.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a function of wealth or even material goods, but a function of power. Do people have the power over their own lives to seek things which are not necessarily the high end of income, but are the fulfilling things they want to do with their lives? You know, the other thing, when I've had this conversation with younger people, it really rings the bell with them, Maria, because they don't see, I mean, they just came into the story, right? They weren't here 50 years ago or even 30 years ago. They're young and their eyes are open and they can see what's around them. And they just seem like, well, of course, that's what we want. Not everybody under 30 makes that choice, obviously. And many people can't make that choice. They have to work two jobs or, you know, whatever, to try to have a family and to keep the mortgage paid or the rent or whatever. I think this is a subject everybody could talk about with some expertise because they've experienced elements of it. And I mean even people with affluent incomes. You hear it from them as well.
One of the most profound you make is about this, I think you called it the denial of the dignity of self-directed lives, where people at work, in the public sphere, at home, they don't have the ability to exercise the decisions in their own daily lives that govern their own daily lives. You called it command and control over our destinies.
Yeah.
And that people become accustomed to taking orders from people, and they get resigned and subservient.
Yes. This woman who called me the other day, who sent me the midnight email or the 3 a.m. email, her name is Gina, and those are things that Gina mentioned. This is an old idea. It's not a new idea. And people in organized labor were saying this 150 years ago. People need to own their own work. And I don't mean own necessarily in a, you know, I've got a title or even a contract, but an understanding that whatever work you do, you should have self-direction. That doesn't mean there are no bosses. It doesn't mean that it's anarchy. It just means that the process and the decision-making surrounding your work, you should have a voice in that. And the best companies, as we know, do that because they understand that engaging people, whether they're in the front office or the assembly line or out back in the garage, brings their knowledge and their talents more directly into the production process itself. So this is not pro or con capitalism or even corporations, but it does require you to reorganize those.
Right. It is definitely linked to the current system of the employment sector.
Yeah.
I wonder if this is the optimum time to see some of these changes that you're talking about. And there are some alternative models that you talked about in this book, Come Home America. And some of these are new social enterprises, the social corporation, kind of democratic co-ops.
I feel a very strong conviction that employee ownership in one form or another, either by direct share ownership or cooperative arrangements or others, is part of our way out of this command and control society. You've heard me go through examples. There may have been California, by the way, usually younger, smaller companies. Silicon Valley had elements of this from the start, although they didn't usually include everybody. They included, you know, the techies and the people in the front office, not necessarily the people doing assembly, but they could. This is hard to do. You're asking people, both the employees, workers, bosses, to change themselves. They have to change rather deep inherited attitudes toward power. Who gets to talk? Who gets to participate?
You know, and unfortunately, people don't really have knowledge about things like cooperatives and how to build cooperatives and that kind of a thing, worker-owned companies. That has not been a model that we have been looking at.
Well, there's a lot of them around, you know. There are a couple million of them if you start counting. Surprisingly, more numerous. Then there's something like 11,000, I think, directly employee-owned companies. And that's through employee share ownership trusts and so forth and so on. These were ideas 100 years ago and more recently than that. So you're right. I'm agreeing with you that the element of American culture was kind of snuffed out for different reasons, including the arrangements even created in the New Deal years allowed the big companies to get bigger, 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 and then to monopolize, if not in the pure legal sense, in the predatory sense. You see a lot of this in California as well, where the small innovative companies get to a certain size, and they're proving that they know something the big guys don't know, and they're succeeding, and they're profitable. And at some point, they hit not a ceiling exactly, but a sort of critical moment when the big capital, the larger companies, will step up and buy them out or try to push them out or respond in different ways, where many owners at that stage, quite understandably, say, let's get our capital out and give it up because we can't compete with these big guys the way the rules work now. I think the crisis is an opportunity for people to step back from the way things have worked in this country for a lot of years, two or three, four decades, and ask, okay, what is our vision? And what I'm trying to do, Maria, is coax people out of their resignation and their sense of hopelessness and say, you've got a right to dream a little bit now. What do you think the society should become? Obviously, I think my ideas are the best, but that's not the point of the book. The point of the book is to jar people into thinking what they would see in the future. Out of that process becomes power for citizens, but you can't skip over it. You can't simply wait till somebody delivers a speech and tells you what to think.
We're speaking with William Grider. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Maria.
William Grider is author of Who Will Tell the People?, Secrets of the Temple, and Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. When we come back, we explore if the United Nations is achieving its sustainable development goals. Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. In 2015, the United Nations passed the Sustainable Development Goals with targets for poverty reduction, economic development, environmental protection, and political empowerment. In this interview, our contributing host, Doug Becker, discusses how they were chosen, how well they are achieving their goals, and how sustainability is being defined and measured.
In 2015, the United Nations General Assembly passed a series of 17 goals in the areas of sustainable development, poverty reduction, and political empowerment. These are intended to focus international actors on common, measurable, and clearly identifiable targets to improve living conditions worldwide. They were the result of lengthy and often contentious negotiations. On today's show, we will explore the Sustainable Development Goals, their history, their enactment, and the current progress towards their achievement. My guest is Pamela Chasek, the chair of the Political Science Department and professor at Manhattan College. She is the co-author of Transforming Multilateral Diplomacy, The Inside Story of the Sustainable Development Goals, along with Macharia Kumau and David O'Connor. Professor Chasek, thank you for joining us. Let me start with a basic question. What exactly are the Sustainable Development Goals?
The Sustainable Development Goals are a set of 17 goals, as you explained, that were negotiated by the United Nations following the end of the period of the Millennium Development Goals. I'll explain them in a minute. The Sustainable Development Goals were designed in a way to operationalize the concept of sustainable development, both in the social, economic, and environmental sectors, as well as a new area to the sustainable development agenda, which is peace, justice, and strong institutions. And so in 2000, the United Nations held a Millennium Summit, and they adopted the UN Millennium Declaration, which committed their nations to a new global partnership to reduce extreme poverty and set out a series of time-bound targets with a deadline of 2015. Those have been known as the Millennium Development Goals. The goals themselves, which were limited. There were only 8 of them, and were actually devised by a small group of UN bureaucrats building upon the Millennium Declaration, was a way to measure progress in these primarily social development areas. And what they found that once there were targets and timetables, that most of the global development assistance, both private and public, started focusing on achieving these goals. It gave direction to a lot of development assistance, as well as to priorities in a number of developing countries. The Millennium Development Goals were aimed primarily at developing countries, and the role of developed countries was to actually provide the funding, the necessary technology, and capacity building. Those goals were due to expire in 2015, and as early as 2010, the United Nations was trying to figure out what would replace them. Would they just roll over these goals for the ones that hadn't been completed? Would they come up with a new set of development goals? And during the preparations for the Rio Plus 20 UN Conference on Sustainable Development, a woman diplomat by the name of Paula Caballero from Colombia said, well, what if we were to actually create a set of sustainable development goals that could then build upon and replace the Millennium Development Goals, but also address the underlying causes for poverty, for environmental degradation, and for lack of economic development?
First, to take a little bit of a step back, the United Nations sets these development goals partially to have an influence over the way in which we define what is development and what ultimately states and state leaders should focus on when talking about the need for economic growth. But the actual actors who make those decisions, who make the public policies that are responsible for setting development goals, are actually state leaders, you know, our government officials or government leaders. What's the relationship between the UN setting these goals and the policymakers, the US president or the prime ministers or our presidents around the world? What might compel them to even adopt and to even listen to the UN as the United Nations is trying to redefine or at least create some sort of definition on what is economic development?
First of all, for the Millennium Development Goals, this was an issue, because the Millennium Development Goals were created by a group of, you know, high-level UN bureaucrats behind closed doors and were then presented to the world as this, thou shalt do this. And it took over 5 years before governments, developing countries in particularly, funding organizations such as the World Bank and others, got on board. The difference with the Sustainable Development Goals is they were negotiated by governments. And so those policymakers in capital were providing inputs into this process from the very beginning. So the Sustainable Development Goals were created by governments and by civil society for governments and for civil society.
So that's one of the key differences between the SDGs and the MDGs, is the fact that the SDGs were negotiated and the MDGs were just sort of handed down from on high.
Right. It's a top-down versus bottom-up process.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But then you also mentioned that where kind of the foundations for coming up with these new sustainable development goals came at the Rio Plus 20, which is an environmental conference.
It was not an environmental conference. It was actually the UN Conference on Sustainable Development. And one of the biggest challenges we've had in terms of operationalizing this concept of sustainable development, which became sort of well known as back as the 1980s, was that for many people in the development sector, they made the same comment that you just made, that sustainable development equals environment. But sustainable development doesn't equal environment. Sustainable development deals with both social development, environmental degradation, and economic development, and how the three are interrelated, and you really cannot address one without addressing the other.
So you're talking about the definition of sustainability, the three spheres of social,
right,
economic, and environmental.
Exactly. And then with regard to what emerged in the SDGs, they also added on one additional goal on peace, justice, and strong institutions, recognizing that you cannot have sustainable development if you do not have a peaceful society and you do not have rule of law. And at the same time, you cannot have peace or rule of law without sustainable development.
Now, the Millennium Development Goals were pretty unique, in particular for the UN, in that it had not only identifiable goals, but identifiable targets. One of the things the UN had been criticized, and it has been criticized really since its founding, is it's a great place to negotiate, but is the UN system ever held accountable for not realizing the goals that it set out, and that the MDGs set out very specific measurable goals?
Measurable targets.
So how effective were the MDGs at actually hitting those targets? And it was a 15-year period. After 15 right. years, was
well,
it successful?
What you found among some of the accomplishments of the MDGs, and mind you, when you set these aspirational goals and targets, it is unlikely that they will be met. And that leads to a whole other discussion. Does that mean they're a failure? So if you started with, say, 75% of children, elementary age children around the developing world in school, and you ended up with 90% in school, but not 100%, is that a failure? Well, you have a lot more kids who are in school, and at the end of the MDG period, you actually did have 90% of children that were in elementary school. The share of the most impoverished people, those living on less than $2 a day, was reduced by 50% during those 15 years. An equal number of girls and boys started school, whereas prior to the MDGs, there was an advantage to boys. Well, as of 2015, there were still many children dying before age 5. 17,000 fewer children died. Maternal mortality, mothers dying during pregnancy and childbirth, was cut in half. 2.3 billion more people had access to clean water. These were some of the targets that were set by the MDGs, and these were some of the results, you know, at the conclusion of that period in 2015. So, yes, there was progress. Similarly, with the SDGs, there are targets and there are indicators that have been developed. The targets were part of the negotiated process, and then the indicators were developed primarily by the UN Statistics Commission. Now, unlike the MDGs, there are 17 Sustainable Development Goals and 169 targets.
some of the challenges that were faced under the MDGs were that you had a number of countries that were gathering data for evaluation, and it turned out that the data gathering capacity for a lot of these countries was pretty limited. That at the beginning in 2000, simply the ability to be able to measure some of these specific targets were pretty limited. Whereas as a result, in part because of the data gathering that's required under the MDGs, countries just got better at measuring their data and collecting their data. Is that still improving? How much confidence do we have that the data that's being reported is actually pretty accurate?
One can never know because, you know, countries can choose how they gather their data and what data they actually gather and whether they're going to show progress or not. And that's usually what you find at the country level. You know, countries have their own priorities and will choose, pick and choose what data they're going to collect. There's also global data gathering that the United Nations has been doing for a very long time. And so you actually have two levels of data here. You have the global data that the UN gathers, and then you have country data that individual countries are responsible for. You know, this is not a legally binding treaty. Countries can gather what they want. Countries can present whichever data that they wish to present, and nobody is going to go back in and, you know, without permission and look to see what's right or wrong with that data. Mm-hmm. So the UN data may also have its flaws, but a lot of the indicators that were developed to measure accomplishment of the SDGs were based on existing data. So what they looked for indicators as much as possible of things that the UN has been collecting over time, so that way they can create several, you know, starting points and measure progress from there.
So there was quite a bit of success with the MDGs, though certainly they were not completely successful. There's still a great deal of growth needed. There's still a great deal of progress needed. Were there specific areas that did well under the Millennium Development Goals, maybe other areas that didn't do as well?
Yes. First of all, because and I don't have all of the data in front of me, mm-hmm. but I think the areas where there was the least progress was reducing child mortality and improving maternal health. That they made progress, particularly in HIV, malaria, and other diseases, and that was largely through cooperation of the private sector and a number of foundations that focused on those. Like, for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation made malaria one of its top priorities, and you could see improvements in fighting malaria, which was one of the MDGs. You know, the ones that did not receive much attention was the environmental sustainability, which was MDG 7, with the exception of clean water, and MDG 8, the Global Partnership for Development, which was aimed primarily at more assistance from the global north to the global south. Mm-hmm. But what's very important to remember is that the MDGs were aimed at developing countries. The SDGs, on the other hand, are universal. All countries are asked to implement the SDGs. So from the United States all the way down to some of the smallest countries in the world, whether they're developed or developing, the SDGs are for all countries versus the MDGs that were just for the developing world.
Yeah, that recognition that issues of poverty or lack of political empowerment or you know, questions about environmental sustainability are not limited to, you know, to poorer countries, but we have those same challenges in wealthier countries and trying to bridge those gaps, not just from country to country, but within countries, can play a pretty significant role.
Exactly. And one of the most interesting parts of the SDG negotiations were presentations from developed countries that showed where were their high rates of poverty and the fact that lack of female participation in governance and lack of fresh water or clean water and food insecurity and such in the developed world. And this really opened the eyes of many developing countries that, you know what? You know, they're not all that perfect.
So the book goes into details about the negotiations. Was there anything unique about these negotiations compared to typical UN negotiations?
What was interesting about the negotiations is it really democratized negotiations, because usually when you're dealing with sustainable development issues within the UN, the first speaker is always whoever has the chairmanship of the Group of 77 in China, which are the developing countries mm-hmm. that China often associates with. The next speaker is usually whoever's speaking on behalf of the European Union. And then the non-European Union developed countries, so Australia, New Zealand, Canada, US, Switzerland, etc., and a lot of the former Eastern Bloc countries, usually speak on behalf of themselves. So that leads this very, who takes up more of the bandwidth are the non-developing countries, because mm-hmm. they speak usually under one voice. And what the SDG negotiations did was really put these major groups, caucuses, coalitions to the side and allowed individual countries to speak more. And this was, I don't know how much you want me to get into mm-hmm. the negotiations themselves, but this was a really interesting part of the negotiations.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're talking with Pamela Chasick about the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. I know that there was a group called the Open Working Group that was instrumental at setting the agenda and launching the Sustainable Development Goals. What exactly is the Open Working Group? What did they do as far as setting the stage for the negotiations?
Well, what happened was that during RioPlus20, in the language of the outcome document, which was called The Future We Want, they said that in that language that they would create an open working group that will comprise of 30 representatives nominated by member states from the 5 United Nations regional groups, with the aim of achieving fair, equitable, and balanced geographic representation. And this working group was going to negotiate the SDGs. But it left a lot of questions. Like anything, the conclusion of one negotiation at the UN always leads to another one, which negotiates, well, what exactly did they mean? So in this case, the question was, well, what does open mean? Because the language in RioPlus20 said that it needs to be open to all stakeholders. But if it's limited to 30, what does that mean? Does that mean only 30 governments can participate? How do you make it open to stakeholders? What does open mean? And what does 30 mean? So when they were working out, asking for nominations of who these 30 should be, 70 countries expressed interest. So the question is, usually when more countries express interest at the UN than there are seats, they have elections, each of the regional groups. So there's the African group, the Asia Pacific group, the Latin American and Caribbean group, the Eastern European group, and the Western European and others. The others refer to Australia, New Zealand, US, and Canada, are the 5 groups. So usually they have elections within their groups, and then those countries serve. Well, in this case, there was fear that if countries who wanted to serve couldn't serve, would they maybe sabotage this once it came back to the General Assembly for adoption? So they were trying to figure out what to do. And so a representative from Pakistan claims, and I believe him, what if we were to share seats? And he was chairing the Asia group, Asia Pacific group at the time. And the countries in Asia Pacific immediately started pairing up into groups to share seats. And then this sort of spread to the other regional groups that, hey, why don't we share seats too? And that way they were able to get the 70 countries all sharing the 30 seats. Some of them were sort of logical, but there were a lot of strange bedfellows, so to speak, or seatmates. And perhaps one of my favorites was Iran, Japan, and Nepal. And 3 countries that really have very little in common.
Right.
But what had happened was Japan was holding out for its own seat, which didn't happen. And at the very end, who was left but Iran and Nepal? So they actually became seatmates. They very rarely spoke with a single voice. But at the end of the negotiations, both the Iranian delegate and the Japanese delegate said that they really understand each other much better now, and they had actually become friends mm-hmm. after sitting together for 15 months.
Yeah.
So, and what was also very interesting was there was no seat held just by European Union countries. Those were all split up. So you had Netherlands and the UK with Australia. You had Denmark, Ireland, and Norway. Norway's but not part of the EU. France, Germany, and Switzerland, who's not part of the EU.
Mm-hmm.
Italy, Spain, Turkey. So that made EU coordination very challenging because they were had to also coordinate with non-EU countries. So it ended up, you know, they ended up calling these the troikas, even though some were just two countries and some seats were three, and there was one seat that was shared by the four North African countries. But the chairs ended up referring to them as the troikas. But this really democratized it, and then any other country that wanted to participate could. So they set up a hierarchy that first the troikas would speak, and then any other non-troika member who was present would get the opportunity to speak. However, if a government, a non-troika government, brought a minister, or in one case a head of state, they could speak first. And that was a way of getting the buy-in from the ministers, going back to your earlier question. And so as they learned that, ooh, they could jump the line if they brought a high-level participant, a number of countries started bringing in ministers.
Now, one thing that really strikes me about the Sustainable Development Goals, first and foremost, is that there's a lot more of them. There's
yes.
17 goals where there was only eight. A second thing was that they are considerably greener. There are a lot more references to environmental issues, on issues of climate change and biodiversity and ocean health, et cetera, that were kind of subsumed into one kind of large goal. And you had referenced earlier that clean water was pretty much the only specific green initiative that seemed to get some traction. What do you think was the driving force behind the fact that the Sustainable Development Goals, even in their name, are considerably greener than the Millennium Development Goals?
Unlike the Millennium Development Goals, the SDGs were looking at both the causes and the consequences of development. And you need to build in that environmental degradation does not help you get out of poverty, does not help you achieve no hunger. Your health is totally impacted by the quality of the environment in which you're living. Similarly, how can you alleviate poverty if there's no decent work available in your country or in your where you live? How can you have a clean environment if you've got dirty industry and not developing clean industry? How can you address poverty, health, hunger, education, etc., if there are deep-seated inequalities within the country? How can you have a clean environment if you are producing too much waste and polluting too much? Everything is integrated. And it's not simple. During the negotiations, there were a number of people who, you know, said that, oh, well, there should be, you know, in the beginning, some were saying, oh, we should stick with eight because eight worked for the MDGs. Others said, oh, maybe we should have 10, or maybe we should have 12 because 12 is, you know, we could have four goals for each of the three pillars of sustainable development or dimensions of sustainable development. Others called for 15, saying we should have 15 goals that, you know, in 2015 that will be accomplished in 15 years. Mm-hmm. And they tried, I've got to say, in terms of, you know, trying to get it down to 15. But every time they suggested merging goals or deleting goals or something else, it didn't work. That there, you know, at one point they were saying, well, what if we make climate change a cross-cutting issue and have it integrated within all the goals and just eliminate the goal for climate change? But then I remember Saba Karosi, who is one of the co-chairs, said, well, if we eliminate climate change, how can I go home to my daughter and tell her there's no goal for climate, which she sees as the biggest issue threatening her generation. So each time they tried, it didn't work. And so there was an interesting, you know, after they were adopted, John MacArthur, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, wrote a blog post called Why 17 is a Beautiful Number. And he writes about how he informed his mother, who is a retiree in Vancouver, Canada, that all UN member countries had agreed on a new set of global goals. And she said, oh, that's terrific. But he confessed there was a problem. There were 17 of them and 169 targets. And he wrote, my mom's response caught me off guard, to say the least. 17 is a great number, she enthused. And when he asked her to explain, given the fact she was the first person who actually liked the number 17, she said, the world is complicated. If they had come back with some Letterman-style top 10, then I probably wouldn't have believed them.
Interesting.
And so, and that proved during the negotiations, you know, sustainable development is complicated. You can't just package it into a nice small set. And a lot of people complain, oh my God, 169 targets. You know, how in the world is any country going to be able to measure 169 targets? But the thing is, countries don't. Countries have the ability to choose, even though this is an integrated agenda and everything affects everything else, countries have the ability to pick and choose those goals and those targets that are most relevant to them. So, for example, if you're Belarus and you are a landlocked country, maybe SDG 14 is not, which is life is oceans, mm-hmm. is not so important to you. Why should you be forced to develop your own, you know, targets and, you know, develop, you know, implement the targets and indicators when you don't have a coastline?
Now, one of the real challenges when I teach the Sustainable Development Goals in my classes, the students frequently have never heard of them. I don't remember the Sustainable Development Goals ever being raised in any of the debates or any conversation in Congress about the U.S.'s commitment to the Sustainable Development Goals. So with that in mind, what can we do as Americans to try to raise their profile here in the United States?
Actually, what we're finding in the United States is that a number of cities and localities have taken them on board. New York City is one example, where I live, as well as numerous cities around the country are incorporating the SDGs into their own city planning and development planning. Similarly, you find on climate change, cities are where it's at. Cities are making a lot of policies surrounding climate change, as well as the SDGs. Now, sometimes you hear them referred to as the global goals, mm-hmm. Because some people felt that if you say the word sustainable development, if you include the word United Nations, that you'll probably not get, you know, buy-in. But if you refer to them by the simple, the global goals, that you will find that more people will incorporate them. And if you look, there are a number of reports out there from different cities, and actually cities have come and reported into the UN on what they are doing. The biggest problem we have at the national level is that the U.S. was never, well, the Obama administration committed the United States to the SDGs when they were adopted at the High-Level Sustainable Development Summit in New York at UN headquarters in 2015. And he, you know, he called on the U.S. to address our own domestic inequalities and shortcomings. He recognized that these goals were ambitious, but he also welcomed them as a tool of greater international cooperation. However, as we know, you know, 1 year later, you know, the Obama administration was over and Donald Trump was elected as president. And the Trump administration is really not very favorable to the United Nations. And essentially has not been vocal about the implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals. In fact, any mention of the 2030 agenda in any UN resolution now elicits a caveat from the United States, reminding the international community that these goals are voluntary. And so they've, if you look at this year's General Assembly, on anything that mentioned the 2030 agenda for sustainable development or the SDGs, the U.S. has issued an explanation of position. And which always says, we applaud the call for shared responsibility. However, the 2030 agenda recognizes that each country must work towards implementation in accordance with its own national policies and priorities, which is true. But as a result, you're not going to find much coming from Washington, and you're probably not going to find much coming from Congress.
And with that, we'll end this by pointing out that, again, these goals are targets that are to be measured in 2030. So we have another 10 years, you know, for that. And of course, anybody who's listening that would like to see the profile raised, we are in the middle of an election year. So you can always raise the question and ask people who are running what is going on with the UN goals, with the Sustainable Development Goals. And hopefully we can raise that profile so that the United States can address these questions in the same way that, other countries are.
Right. And each year, actually, the UN does issue a Sustainable Development Goals report that does track, and it's available on the UN Sustainable Development webpage, and it tracks where we're at in terms of the global progress. These are the indicators that the UN has. We're not going to wait until 2030, but actually we're getting data constantly to indicate where things are falling behind, where we need to put more emphasis on which goals and what targets to be able to ensure we come as close to possible at implementing.
And with that, we'll end the conversation. Once again, thank you very much, Pam Chasek. We will talk very soon.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Pamela Chasek is the chair of the Political Science Department and professor of political science at Manhattan College. She is the co-author of Transforming Multilateral Diplomacy, The Inside Story of the Sustainable Development Goals with Macharia Kamau and David O'Connor.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, contributing host Doug Becker, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armodian, and we'll see you next week.